Hello and welcome to a brand new series of The Dentist Podcast. I'm Eddie McKenzie, editor of The Dentist magazine, and today I'm in conversation with Nigel Jones of Practice Plan. Nigel is the sales and marketing director of the Practice Plan group of companies, which includes Practice Plan, DPAS, and Medenta. And today we're looking at emerging from COVID, the impact that the pandemic has had, and what dentistry will look like as we do move forwards. But before that, here's a quick word about our sister publication, Dental Update.
Dental Update is written by clinicians for clinicians, providing high-quality clinical content to general dental practitioners and dental care professionals. Every issue includes the latest peer-reviewed best practice in dentistry, highly illustrated articles covering the latest procedures and techniques in dentistry, 44 hours of CPD every year, and access to an archive dating back to 1999. For more information, visit dental-update.co.uk.
Hi Nigel, thanks for joining us today to kick off this new series of podcasts. We set the topic for today's conversation as emerging from COVID, and within that we'll be looking at the impact that the pandemic has had on the world of dentistry. I wonder if we could start though just by setting the scene and looking at the landscape prior to the pandemic hitting, and if you could just give us a 50,000 foot overview of some of what you see as the longer term trends that were occurring in dentistry.
Well, I think there were a number of interesting things that were happening before COVID. You could definitely sense that move towards private dentistry. It was not necessarily going at the speed that I think people had anticipated and thought that it might do, but the direction of travel, I think, was very clear. And a lot of that, I think, stemmed from the dissatisfaction of the profession with the NHS. We did quite a bit of research in the years leading up to the pandemic, just comparing and contrasting attitudes towards dentistry amongst both NHS practitioners and private practitioners. And whilst there are clear challenges, no matter which sector you operate in or predominantly operate in, it was very, very clear those challenges were felt most keenly by those working within the NHS. And I think a good example of that was around the tension that I think exists between, particularly in England, where you have the pressure of the activity targets to meet, and trying to balance that against the requirements of the GDC. And some of the questions that we asked, which I think were quite interesting, were to do with, as an NHS dentist, how able do you feel to manage patient expectations? And how able do you feel to communicate effectively with patients? And it was very clear that NHS dentists felt that was a far more challenging task than those in the private sector. So you could see there was this very strong leaning towards the private sector. I think something that's become quite relevant right now, but definitely had its origins many, many years ago, are workforce challenges within dentistry. And I think that for a few years there had been potentially some masking of those underlying issues. The number of dentists had increased fairly steadily year on year. But what wasn't being recorded were things like the full-time equivalent nature of the profession. And I think that was almost certainly declining, particularly as those longer-term trends in moving towards a more female-orientated workforce than a male-orientated workforce, where part of the appeal seems to be able to balance the home life and the bringing up of a family with a career, but then lent itself to more part-time working. And I think that wasn't really properly understood, and the longer term impacts of that, I don't think, had been properly thought through. I think we did see just in the run up to the pandemic, the impact of Brexit on workforce as well. Certainly, I think there were early signs that fewer dentists were coming into the UK from Europe, and many more were leaving to return to the Europe, to the continent. I think that also applies to dental nurses, not just dentists. So I think that was an interesting trend as well. I think that will, I think, manifest itself as quite a big issue in the future to do with the availability of resource for the government. And I think that's going to be a bit of a challenge when it comes to NHS dentistry, because you could see how over a number of years government had started to exert more and more control over NHS dentistry, particularly in England. But its financial commitment proportionally had been reducing, and that trend of seeing successive increases in patient charges helping to then offset that reduction in government expenditure, I think was a really interesting point. And yes, say that sense of less financial commitment but more control, I think is something that is was already unnerving the profession before the pandemic, and has probably become more intense since. And then I think some of the other things, such as, you know, seeing flexible commissioning, some sort of more innovative things that were starting to happen to try and repair some of the damage to the NHS dentistry that was being done. That was interesting, and I'm sure that we'll see more of that in the future, although it is so far from being a silver bullet to the problems. It's not true, but you can see some effort was being made in that area. So, you know, it was quite interesting, and that shift to private dentistry that all of those factors was helping to create, I think you could see that growth in cosmetic dentistry. In our patient finance business, that was very evident. We could see we were getting more and more successful each year. The demand from patients was growing, and that was even before the pandemic. And certainly, as I'm sure we'll touch on, the pandemic has accelerated and propelled that even further forward.
Just to look at the first point you mentioned there about dissatisfaction, I wonder sometimes when these surveys come out how much stock we should put in them. Because I remember when I first started at the dentist, reading about how unhappy dentists were, NHS dentists were, and how a large percentage were thinking of leaving. And I then waited for the next few months for that to happen. But of course, it didn't. And so I always have to remind myself now that whilst these surveys are a true reflection of how people are feeling, that doesn't necessarily mean that feeling will lead to any change. It's a bit like actually the frogs in a pot, isn't it? That yes, they are unhappy and might even feel hot, but because it's a gradual thing, they get used to it, and so they don't actually take any action, even though perhaps they should. Is that something that you can relate to, or how seriously do you take the surveys when they come out?
I think that's a great question, and well, I began helping dentists leave the NHS and go private in 1990, when people were trying to escape what was then called the new contract. And I can remember sitting in meeting rooms of 200 plus people, with all of them basically saying, that's it, we're off out, we're going to leave the NHS. And if 10% did, I'd be slightly surprised. So I think your point about intent versus action is very well made. And certainly someone that has to have a look at this from a commercial point of view, I can't use those surveys to base my forecasts on. It's more just a general sense in which things are likely to move. So I think you're quite correct in highlighting it's not necessarily that they're not dissatisfied and that they won't do something. You just have to be mindful of the pace of change, which is a lot slower than the surveys would indicate. Your use of the boiling frogs analogy, I think, is very appropriate, because that's certainly what I think I've seen over the 31, 32 years that I've been working with the profession, is the resilience of the profession, their ability to sort of cope what's thrown at them is remarkable. I always think, though, that at various points, obviously that whole issue there is the heat is turned up slowly, so that people don't really notice the incremental change. But every so often, it's almost like whoever's turning up the heat on the profession slips slightly, and the heat goes up, and then a proportion of the frogs jump out of the hot water. But it's not enough to get them all out, but it's enough to get some of them out. And at various points over those 30, 31 years, that's what's happened. I do think, though, that we might be entering a different phase, and I think it could be that an awful lot of things are now combining to mean that there could be a change that's irreversible and suddenly sped up.
Just on that, you touched there on dentistry changing, and we tend to think of that, or at least I tend to think of that, in terms of the contract and that being a driver for change. I wonder actually if it's not going to be something more like a broader societal change that has a bigger impact? Just people viewing dentistry in a different way or demanding different things, whether that's wanting cosmetic treatments or wanting things like implants, something that they're not going to get on the NHS. Is it perhaps a case that the frustration of the system that the profession will put up with, but actually the reality of the market forces and patient demand will be the real driver for change?
I think, again, a very interesting point. So I would say, yes, I think the demand from patients is going to be a significant driver for change. In addition, is the workforce point. And I think you're right that some of those historical sudden upturns in heat have been driven by some kind of contractual change. 1990 contract, 92 fee cut, Bloomfield Review of 96, the obvious 2006 contract. You know, there have been moments when the system has become more frustrating and more irritating, so people have gone for it. But I think, whilst I still think that will happen, so you get the situation like the 85% and the 100% that to come in April for dentists in England will increase that level of frustration and maybe prompt more action. I think a new contract is maybe a little bit of a way off. So the ability of that to potentially drive change, I think, is going to be somewhat dampened. What I think will drive change is supply and demand factors, as you've indicated. The supply point, I think, is going to be probably the key thing. That if there aren't enough dentists available to fulfil the requirements of NHS contracts in England, practice owners are going to be forced to go private or reduce the size of their NHS contracts if the LAT is agreeable to that. And I think that in itself will mean that you have, you know, because most dentists, when they go private, halve the number of patients they're seeing. That's a rough rule of thumb. Sometimes it's more, sometimes it's slightly less, but roughly we'll see half the number of patients, which means half their original patient list is then out there looking for another dentist. And that then strengthens the position for those that want to go private, because that means there's an further increase in demand, and yet the supply issues aren't being addressed. So actually, and somebody else could go private and so on and so forth. And I think that's going to be that I think will drive more rapid change than anything, is that you've got a situation at the moment where dentists working under NHS contracts have been working at significantly less than 100% of their activity targets whilst their income has been maintained. And we're now at the point where they've just gone up to 85%, and it will be going up again, as I said before, to 100%. Income's not going to change. They've kind of got used to working at that slightly slower pace, with the benefits that it can bring, like managing patient expectations, like building rapport and communicating more effectively. And all of a sudden, they're going back to that treadmill. And if I'm an NHS associate who's going to get paid the same for working a lot faster and harder, and I know that there is a vacancy at the local private practice where I could potentially get paid more and go back to working at that slightly slower pace I've enjoyed so much during the pandemic, I think it's going to become increasingly hard for NHS practices to hang on to their associates. Without associates, and we know the recruitment and retention issues are challenging at the moment, means replacing an associate is not that straightforward. How do they fulfil the activity requirements? And you're right about the demand from patients. Again, we've seen that it's been remarkable for us, actually, on the patient finance side of things. I know you've referenced before in the past the Zoom booms. We've certainly seen the evidence of that, you know, people seeing themselves in that little picture in the corner of their screens as they work day in, day out in front of their laptops, has definitely prompted much, much greater demand for straighter, whiter teeth. And we did three or four times as much as we were expecting to in loan value last year than we budgeted for. And that comes about because of that great demand. So you've got this really interesting thing, I think, where the demand from patients is seems to be going up and up and up. I also think I should add to that, there's a greater health consciousness at the moment. So those people that valued their oral health value it even more in the context of valuing all health even more. So the demand, I think, is growing, but that supply, if anything, is worsening. you know, whether it's to do with Brexit, whether it's to do the increase in part-timers because of that gender shift. But also there's an awful lot of dentists who post-pandemic are thinking, actually, I can't work at the intensity I was. I'd rather work 3 days a week than 4.5 or 5 days a week at that. So that FTE problem becomes greater. And then there's the fact that there's clearly an awful lot of people in every walk of life that are reevaluating what their purpose on the planet is and are thinking, is it really worth me working longer to build up a bigger pension that I might not be physically able to benefit and enjoy much? Maybe I need to get out now while I can do something with my life. So I think those supply and demand factors will be the bigger driver of change than contract reform or contract tinkering.
Yeah. And actually, just in terms of supply and demand, it seems slightly strange thinking of dentistry in terms of supply and demand, because I imagine a lot of patients wouldn't even think of dentistry as a marketplace in the same way they would other markets. Many patients will stick with the practice they've always been with just simply because it's the practice they've always been with. Or if they do move, they might stay, they might limit themselves and only look at other NHS practices just simply because they have an affiliation with a wider NHS brand. Or at least that used to be the case. Of course, now we're in a slightly unique situation because of the closures and because of the backlog of appointments. The difficulty in getting an appointment means that there are now a whole host of patients who are looking for a new practice, and they are perhaps willing or actively wanting to go private for the first time. It really is opening up the market in terms of the demands placed upon it. And of course, there's no guarantee that once people have gone to a new practice that they'll then return to their old one. If seen properly, and if you see a patient when they're in pain or in desperate need, actually, that in itself brings a sense of loyalty, doesn't it?
I think that's a fascinating point, that, and it's something that I've been reflecting on actually for a number of years, but particularly so during the course of the pandemic, is the public attitude and perception of dentistry. So it's always made me sort of slightly smile that the profession gets so worried about what the public perception of the profession is, because actually, it doesn't really matter to them. It's what their patients' perception of them is that matters. So as long as their patients love them, if anything, the fact that the rest of the profession is portrayed in a negative way is helpful, because actually it makes them less likely to go and try someone new. But I, as you say, I think the circumstances now, where waiting lists are everywhere and people are actually much more mobile than they've ever been, I think it is really interesting, because I think it's opening up people's eyes to two really important things. That firstly, private dentistry is not as unaffordable as they thought it was. Now, I'm generalizing terribly there, because there are some people, particularly those just above the sort of thresholds for income support, that kind of thing, where that, there's that sort of gray area, the working poor, where which I would never want to trivialize the financial challenges that they're under. But for an awful lot of people, there's been an assumption that private dentistry is for the stars and the celebrities. And because they're now forced to go and find a private dentist, they're realizing actually this isn't quite as expensive as I thought, especially when you bear in mind NHS costs have grown over the years. So the gap between private costs and NHS costs has narrowed quite a bit. And then the other thing, I think, is that the way the profession has been portrayed historically in the media has been to draw on some of the negatives. And there's loads and loads of obvious examples, from the Little Shop of Horrors type thing to the various kind of catastrophic type stories that appear in the press. With this whole move towards cosmetic dentistry and straighter, whiter teeth, more elective dentistry, people, I think, are viewing dentistry as very much life enhancing. Whereas I think what they viewed dentistry before as being something that they were just trying to avoid getting into problems. Whereas this idea that actually and it must be immensely satisfying for those dentists that are involved in it, where you can unlock a whole new social life for someone because you give them the greater confidence, or a whole new career because they can perform more confidently in interviews, that kind of thing. That must be so rewarding. And I think as more and more people get exposed to that and have that impact and spread that good word, the whole attitude towards private dentistry, I think, is shifting. And the receptiveness to it, I think, is definitely massively improved.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly the events of the last couple of years have played a part in that. If we can move on to talking about the pandemic itself, dentistry has been, historically speaking, it's been extremely resilient. Even the
we thought the banking crisis of 2008 was bad, but it's nothing like the last couple of years have been in terms of the forced closures and things. So firstly, I guess, how on earth did practices survive? And secondly, do we have any data yet in terms of what types of practices or what traits were indicative of a practice doing better during that period or less bad, I suppose I should phrase it as? Are we in a position to be able to analyse that at all yet?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, obviously, when the practices all shut down and debate still rages as to whether or not they should have done or didn't actually need to. But I that definitely impacted on people in a number of different ways. I think it's, you know, and it might sound slightly odd coming from me, given what my career has been all about. But I think the NHS or NHS England certainly deserve, well, actually NHS across the whole of the UK and Northern Ireland deserve credit for the way that they supported NHS dentists through both the lockdown and then the pandemic as a whole. So the shutdown and the pandemic as a whole. Because I think I think Sarah Hurley's describing it as income protection. And I think that's probably a fair way of looking at it, that protecting the income of NHS dentists during that time was a good move. And I don't think anyone should try and take away from that. I think the downside to it was that it highlighted the vulnerability of NHS dentists to having only one customer. They may have several thousand patients, but they have one decision maker that determines, you know, their fate, if you like. And that whole stress of waiting to hear what the next activity target was going to be or what the next requirements were going to be, I think that really brought home to a lot of people that although they were getting that income protection, it was at a cost in terms of vulnerability. So I think that's been quite an interesting one. But in terms of vulnerability, it was very clear that private pay-as-you-go practices were going to really struggle. When they couldn't see patients at all, that meant absolutely no income. And with the reduced patient throughput as a result of the precautionary principle and the introduction of fallow time, which again is another topic over which there's much debate. But that had a very negative impact on people that relied on patients coming through the door to generate income. We definitely saw plan practices as having greater financial resilience because that cash flow was maintained. And it was fascinating for me. Oh, sorry, Eddie.
Sorry, I was just going to say on that, was it a case that there were some patients asking for fees to be suspended or reduced at all during that period? I'm sure many were quite happy to carry on paying, but equally I suspect there were some that were thinking maybe they're paying for a service that they aren't actually getting while practices are closed or appointments are limited. So did that happen at all? And what was your advice to practices if they asked you that?
What happened was when the lockdown was first announced at the end of March and into early April when all dental practices were closed, we had a significant spike in cancellations without a shadow of a doubt. The stats show that it was very dramatic. And at that point, I was having to come up with various forecasts for what the future might look like. And most of those forecasts weren't terribly pretty. And it was a slightly nerve-wracking few weeks. But that level of cancellations actually only lasted for about 3 weeks. And it was remarkable after that, actually, that what happened from then on is that the number of cancellations fell to lower levels than it would normally be. The thing that we got hit with was with no patients going into practices for a period of time. And then after that, a reduced number of patients going in, there were fewer joiners. So there's always people that leave because they've always got life events that mean, you know, they move house, they get married, they change jobs. Something happens that triggers them to cancel a dental plan. And I think what happened was that because a lot of those life events got put on hold, the cancellations that would normally follow them got put on hold. But normally we would expect for every patient that's lost for there to be at least another patient, if not a patient and a bit, that joins. It was the joiners that significantly decreased. And that then meant that there was, even though it was depressed levels of cancellations, a decline in the overall patient numbers throughout the spring and summer of last year, of 2020, sorry. But then as things started opening up, it then really really took off. And I think the main driver for that was practices realizing the benefits of that secure cash flow. So if they had 200 patients paying them 15 or 20 pounds a month on a plan, they wanted 400. If they had 400, they wanted 800. So they came out of the first lockdowns with a focus on signing more patients onto plan to help them be more insulated from future lockdowns. But the answer to your specific question about did we give any advice is we would support our practices with whatever they wanted to do in terms of their patient numbers. But we always encouraged them to look at the data and to just check that it wasn't a temporary issue, and that, you know, they were potentially solving a problem that wasn't there if they wanted to reduce their fees. And because of that depth of loyalty that patients had to their individual dentist, I got very, very little negative feedback about it. A lot of our practices, and we were sharing best practice throughout the pandemic, but particularly in those early months, were very good at reaching out to patients. So even if they couldn't see them physically, they would make telephone calls and the team would engage with patients. And I know that was very much appreciated. So it wasn't actually an issue. And there was, I guess, a little bit of thought needed to go into the additional cost of PPE if you were a private dentist. But again, patients proved then to be quite tolerant of things because I think they just thought, I want to hang on to my dentist and I'll do whatever it takes.
Well, that actually touches on to another point. I know a lot of practices, when things first opened up, they were only seeing planned patients when appointments were limited. So at that time, the value of being on a plan really, really increased. So it's a great opportunity. Something like that is a great opportunity to show patients the value and the benefits of, and ultimately to get them signed up, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, quite understandably, what most of the practices that work with us wanted to do was to shore up that loyalty amongst those plan patients because they'd seen just how valuable it had been. I mean, the number of times practice owners had said to me that it really was their only source of income was that monthly payment from practice plan or DPAS. And it actually made a massive difference. We also halved our admin fees in the first couple of months when practices were shut down. And although it's not, a huge amount of money, what we were trying to demonstrate there was that a degree of empathy with the fact that it was those first few weeks while people were trying to work out what on earth they were going to do that were critical. So we were trying to do our bit to help with that. And then after that, I think practices became a lot more adept at planning and thinking through how to adapt and cope.
Well, this goes back to something I know we've discussed in previous interviews, and that's the professionalism of dentistry, or rather the professionalism of the business of dentistry. It perhaps used to be the case that some dentists saw business as a dirty word and weren't necessarily comfortable with it. But actually, increasingly, it seems that people have realized that dentistry does operate within a market and businesses have to act accordingly. I wonder if that's the case, that actually that private practices, those that are set up for and used to dealing with the market, that they were actually in a better position to adapt in a way that perhaps other practices, those in the NHS, just didn't have the flexibility to do.
Yeah, it's a great question. That I think you are right that certainly dentists in the private sector who have got used to sort of concepts like competition and trying to create an offering for patients that was appealing both to the existing patients and to attract new patients in. Yeah. My sense of what happened when things started opening back up again was that independently owned private practices were far more agile and quick off the mark with how they responded to the demands. And, you know, we've got to be really careful in these kind of conversations that we don't overgeneralize. And, certainly I know of some highly professional NHS practices. I know of some private practices that leave a lot to be desired. So it's difficult. Yeah. But as a rule, your observation, I think, is correct. I think it's driven by commercial necessity, which is not necessarily the case in 100% NHS practices.
Yeah, there's a big difference between private dentistry and NHS dentistry. in terms of the way practices need to work in those systems. And the pandemic and coming out of the pandemic has really emphasized that. But I suppose we should say in the heart of the pandemic, it wasn't all bad for the NHS. I know much is being made now of the increased targets, and from 60 to 65 to 85, and it'll be going up to 100 again soon. And whilst I understand that criticism, actually the fact that there was that reduction there in the first place, and there was a protection there for NHS practices, that's something that the private market didn't actually enjoy, is it? I don't know if you have any thoughts on that that you can share.
Well, yes, I think without doubt, there's an element of truth in that. I mean, I think, you know, NHS practices have struggled with patient throughput. There's efficiency issues, the PPE, that loss of the interaction they could have with patients. There's lots of things that mean that the job wasn't exactly the same, just slower. So I think a lot of NHS practices would have felt it difficult. And depending on your circumstances, if you're a bigger practice, you probably can absorb changes more easily than if you're a small single-handed practice, say. Particularly if people were off ill because of COVID, that would have had a disproportionate impact on smaller practices, I think. So I think it was tricky, but I think you're right. Although I think underneath it all, people know that they're unlikely just to have been given that there will be strings attached in some form. There'll be some reckoning at some point in the future. And I do think I don't know that they have been entirely treated that well, because, well, particularly, I think there was a lack of respect for them. This idea of not confirming what the targets were going to be until the 11th hour, I simply struggle to understand how that was ever seen to be acceptable. And even if, because of the volatile nature of the situation, you were trying to leave decisions until the 11th hour because things were changing so much, you would at least let people know that's what you were doing. And I think there just seemed to me to be a lack of empathy for what it's like being an independent contractor. These aren't NHS employees. They're independent contractors running their own businesses. And they're being, you know, they're waiting until the night before to find out how much they're going to be expected to do to carry on getting paid the same amount, and how to organise their appointment books, all of that kind of stuff. So I think there was an awful lot of pressure on NHS dentists. But I do think, back to something we said earlier, that it gave them an insight into what life as a private dentist might be like. And that slightly slower pace did come with some upsides, without a shadow of a doubt. So that I think return to the treadmill is something that is, well, I know is worrying a lot of practices at the moment, both with, you know, both associates and practice owners, because I don't think they're very keen on that idea. And I do think there is an impact on patients as well. I mean, that's I think the thing that, I know I've said that a couple of times already, but I think it's really important that at the heart of all of this, the reason why we do all what we do is because of the patients. And patients' experience when practices aren't quite so frantic is much better. And yes, there are some specific issues to do with the pandemic and the waiting in cars and all of that sort of thing. But as we move out of that, you go back to that very full, busy waiting room, not a chance to really talk to people. I don't think... Many clinical teams will relish that prospect.
Yeah, I know we said earlier about the difficulty in judging what will drive change, but it does feel at the moment as if all the necessary factors are in place for there to be a change. In terms of numbers, though, is it too early at this stage to see that happening, or are you starting to see anything come through yet?
Well, if I tell you that last year was our most successful year since 2007, that probably gives you an indicator. This year, you know, 2022, has started off at the same pace that last year finished. And if anything, I think it's likely to accelerate. Some of the reasons that we, well, the drivers of change that we touched on earlier in the conversation, I think look set to persuade more dentists to think about the private route. The thing I think that's so interesting about the supply and demand point that we were exploring earlier on is what it creates is an opportunity for practice owners or prospective practice owners for that matter, to shape the practice that they've always dreamt of having. Different people have a different view about what the ideal practice is, whether it's a family orientated practice or a young professional orientated practice or whatever it might be. There's never, ever been a better opportunity to shape your vision of a practice. You know, a lot of that was being an exercise that you've done in various courses over the years and you design your entire practice, but it never becomes a reality. Now they can become a reality. And I think that's going to be interesting. And whilst I'm not arrogant enough to think that everyone will come to practice plan, I think as people start exploring what the various options are, I think working with us will be one of the very attractive things. I think the future is looking quite bright for us. And even the Medenta side of our business has started off very well again this year. And we weren't sure whether or not the demand for straighter, whiter teeth, that Zoom boom that we touched on before, would that peter out at some point? Well, there's absolutely no sign of that at the moment. If anything, it's growing even faster. So I think things are looking very good for the practice plan group of companies. I think for private dentistry as a whole, but also for the profession. I think sometimes it doesn't sound a little bit over the top. People are very negative about dentistry when actually what they're really negative about is NHS dentistry. And it's one of the main reasons why I'm still doing what I'm doing after so many years is the satisfaction I get from seeing someone that was a beleaguered NHS dentist lacking in self-confidence become this sort of very proactive, forward-thinking private dentist and loving what their chosen profession was. And I know that sounds a bit gushy and arguably over the top, but it's true. You know, I've gotten so many examples of people who've been completely revitalized by that. And then they realize actually it wasn't dentistry I was disillusioned with. It was the particular type of dentistry I felt forced to provide. And that's why I'm very, very optimistic for the profession as a whole. I'm nervous about the mental health issues. There were a lot of mental health challenges for the profession before the pandemic. That's been exacerbated during the pandemic for a variety of the reasons that we've touched on during the course of the conversation. I do think, their you know, decision making ability is quite tough at the moment. Just surviving to the end of the day is a victory, let alone making big decisions about what the future of your practice might be like. And I think Chris Barrow recently referred to COVID fatigue and how highly transmissible that is. And I totally agree with that. I think he's right that if anything's going to hold the profession back, it's how tired and exhausted they are. But if they are able to galvanize themselves and take a step back, I think they'll see just so much opportunity in the years ahead that, we're going to enter a really, really, you know, it's corny, but golden age of dentistry over the next 10, 15 years, albeit in the short term with, I think, a lot of pain and pressure for those still predominantly in the NHS.
It's funny. I said to you earlier that I was slightly nervous in focusing this conversation on the pandemic because COVID fatigue is definitely setting in everywhere, but that subject might seem a little bit depressing, but actually it's good to hear you sound genuinely positive and optimistic about the future. It isn't a case of doom and gloom. You seem to be saying that there are opportunities out there and the future might actually be bright in spite of everything that's happened. You sound confident.
I am. People would say cynically, well, you would say that because it suits your commercial agenda, et cetera, et cetera. And I understand that cynicism. I keep talking about 30, 31 years of doing this. So I'm not going to be doing this forever. So I'm going to be a kind of more on the sidelines, I think. So I'm much more interested in finding the positives in the situation and divorcing that from commercial opportunities. If commercial opportunities come with it, then great. But actually, I genuinely feel in a slightly privileged position as I hopefully it's a few years yet, but I'm towards the retirement end of my career. And I don't feel the need to bang a particular commercial drum because, it just doesn't, it doesn't fit with me as a person, let alone my stage of life. But I am very positive. My only reservation is that point about the readiness of the profession to embrace the change and maximize the opportunities. There will always be people that take advantage of the situation to the detriment of patients, but the vast, vast majority of dental practitioners that I've interacted with during my career, first and foremost, has been doing the right thing for the patient. And I think that they will feel able to do that now more than, or they will see as the coming years unfold, they'll have greater and greater opportunity for doing exactly what they think is the right thing by the patient.
Well, that's actually a great point. I thought optimism might be the perfect note to end on, but actually a focus on the patient might be more apt, actually, because that's ultimately what it's all about, isn't it? Nigel, it's been great talking to you. Thank you very much. I'm Eddie McKenzie, and this has been the first episode in a new series of The Dentist Podcast.